So, Brother Eric, who are you?
Okay, this is a panel, and the discussion will go between us and...
We are both the interviewers, the panel, and you are all the people doing the speaking, okay?
Right, and everyone can share also and ask questions, but we're given a chance to bring two different topics on the panel, so we thought, let's combine the topic and make it only one, so it would be easier, otherwise everybody will be confused, and by the end of it, you won't know what to think. So, my name is Brother Eric. I'm from Montreal in Canada. I've been... Everybody knows where Canada is, right? So, just over there. And I've been in Guyane for about 23 years now. And I live... I'm originally from France, but I took Guyane in Montreal. And then I went in Western Canada and then back in Montreal for the last few years. So my mother tongue is French. But in Montreal, we do everything bilingual. So there's English, French, and now we do service in Spanish and Hindi. Not me, but we have somebody who does it. And you, Joy?
Well, I'm one of those doubly British-born souls. I was born, physically born in Britain and spiritually born in Britain. Came to Canada, London, UK. There's a London,
there's a
Canada.
London in Canada too. We even have a Cambridge.
Yes. I found a Colchester in the United States, and that's where I was born. But yes. I was born in the UK. No, you can't sit there. Oh, you can translate. Yes, you can sit there. And that was about 29 years ago. So that means that filming that you were talking about was 23 years ago.
It would have been 17 years ago, yeah.
Brother Eric reminded me of a potentially embarrassing, but as I don't remember what the result, and I haven't seen the result, remembering seeing the result, it could be absolutely fine. I think I've seen the other sisters' pictures.
Well, it is actually an illustration of intoxication, because when I came to Guyane, I was 21 years old, and when I met Joy the first time, she must have been not much more, somewhere around that.
Yeah, I came to Guyane when I was 20, so...
Yeah. And I started my professional career at the same time as I became Brahmin. So when I turned out to be Brahmin, I was studying to be a veterinarian. And for strange reason, one day I was called by someone in Western Canada asking me if I wanted to be a journalist. I said, well, sure, why not? You know, as a Brahmin, you don't read newspapers and you have no idea what's going on in the world. So I became a journalist, and my whole career has gone along with my Brahmin life in a very similar way. So every time something major will happen in my Brahmin life, something will happen in my professional life. And one year when I switched from radio journalist to TV journalist, I told them that I was happy to be a TV journalist, but I had a commitment for the month of March, and I had to go to India. So they told me, well, if you're going to India, why don't you do a film, you know? Why don't you do a documentary on what you're doing in India? And I had very little experience with television at the time. I just started a few weeks ago, I think, in television. So we managed to hire someone from TV Bombay, and then we did some kind of shooting. And the plan was to do a documentary on Madhuban, the Forest of Honey, a group of people from Edmonton in Alberta in Canada who were visiting for the first time. And that's when we met, and we needed some sisters to dance on Baba's Rock. So we kind of took Joy. And then it was very entertaining. I mean, some may have seen the result, but we did a half-hour documentary on Madhuban. And TV crew was very, very funny, actually, because the cameraman was working in a very old-fashioned way, and I had very little experience, but I quickly realized that he was not shooting at all the same way that we do in Canada or in the States. So we had to adjust quite a lot, and when we had Joy doing her dance, it was right in front of the sunset. And actually, you should see the full piece, because it's beautiful. She's holding the sun and doing beautiful postures on Baba's Rock, so that's how
it was. What you call a slow motion meditation dance, because it was extremely painful.
Yeah. Imagine
up on Baba's Rock, it's not exactly smooth. I remember that part.
Yeah, it's not flat, and there's a chance to see the angel falling off any time. It's called Madhuban, the Forest of Honey. It's in French, but I think there was... And they're still using it in Paris, strangely enough. And I appear in that movie when I'm 22 or, I don't know, 20-some years old. And it's good now because nobody recognized me. So, Joe, we're going to talk about intoxication and balance. So I'll be more the intoxication part of it, and she'll be more into the balance part of it. So we'll try to figure out how it combines with one another. Let's start with keeping the balance and some hints you were promising to give us. Because we're all very in balance and we all desperately look for some balance.
I wanted to start with a suggestion of kind of a bit of background of information. I, as an occupational therapist, I have to, this is my career, I work in the National Health Service in the UK and help people reorganize themselves after injury. And one of the things it's useful to come to understand is whatever consciousness we are holding, we actually set up the body to support that consciousness. So if I take someone who's depressed as an example, so if you're depressed...
A Brahmin or non-Brahmin?
Non-Brahmin. We'll say non-Brahmin.
We'll start with non-Brahmin. Brahmin. It's been interesting to know what happens to depressed Brahmin.
Actually, it doesn't make any difference. A soul, when the soul chooses to engage in the body, in the sense that it starts to utilize, take from the senses, then the body has a setup. Even in the world of machinery, you have to set the machine for a particular job. So for the soul to express depression through the body, there is a different setup. So, for instance, you kind of look, you know, the muscle tone is very low. The metabolism is very slow. So, but you eat out of sort of, you don't eat, not very like to put on weight. You very like to feel more pain. You don't have any endorphins. You don't do much exercise. You are in a hunched posture, so you don't breathe very well. What else is there? That's pretty good, isn't it? And your thought pattern. Yes, your thought pattern. Your whole perception is very, very narrow on yourself. Or not just on yourself, but on very specific things about yourself, the negative side of yourself. So for every consciousness, there is the thought habits. There is the amount, what the chemical is created in the body, so how much thyroxine the producer, that's how much speed your body has in its metabolism. Then all the various things, the serotonin levels, all these different things that make you alert or make you digest faster, all these things, the body chemistry is a setup. And if you want to change your consciousness, you have to change all these different things. So you can ask a depressed person to, well, sit up straight. And they'll last for a little while and they'll go back like that. But you can ask a depressed person to think positive things. I am a peaceful, positive soul. You know, if you only change one thing, it's very hard. So you want to change everything together. So Baba gives us a timetable which enables us to do that. So he says, to have a balance between sleep and activity. He doesn't actually encourage us to do a lot of exercise, but I think Brahma Baba did, so we can say that's a good idea. But he will say, sit erect in class. Don't sit like this. Sit erect. He wants you to sit erect in class. No, that's right.
And if he doesn't, Daddy will tell us to do
yes.
So.
That's true. It is important. If you want to change your consciousness, sit up straight and relax, and also breathe. Don't forget to breathe. It is important. Because when you breathe, you're changing your chemistry. If you've got any opportunity for changing your chemistry, eating or breathing, or taking a shower, change your consciousness. Not change your consciousness. Make sure your consciousness is in your preferred future. Our new age. Baba says, always have where you're going in your consciousness, or at least Shiv Baba in your consciousness, if not where you're going in your consciousness. And that way you create this constant change, constant newness. Because if you always have the same posture, you always have the same pattern of behavior, you won't change. We have to keep changing. So our daily
routine. How do you find it connected to balance then? Because I think many Brahmins tend to go into really a lot of imbalance in the sense like we want to change and they push the change a lot and they either change, I mean, we change everything drastically when we come to Gyan, the diet and the schedule and everything is changed dramatically. Do you find that it adapts and adjusts automatically or does it take a lot of time before the adjustments can help the consciousness and the physical body to be in balance with one another? Or do you find where a lot of us are still in balance on that level?
I think we need to look at what our daily pattern is like. And if we say, for instance, if we do find ourselves sitting still a lot of the day, then we have to consciously park the car further away and get some walking in there somewhere. Don't use a lift, use the stairs and various tricks that you can get in there to get some exercise. If you are doing a very office-y type job, for instance, make sure that your service role then is a more creative one, not just office again. Because, yes, you might have IT skills, that's very good, but you personally need a range and a balance. So if you're not getting to do drawing or creativity or writing poetry or dancing or singing or giving a chance to share your thoughts, and you're again in the office when you get into the evening, then where's your balance? You have to have that. In the Values and Healthcare program, which is something that Shashi Ben wanted me to mention, so I'm going to get it in there, it's a spiritual workshops to enhance spirituality within healthcare workers. And the spiritual tools in that are creativity, playfulness, listening and meditation, reflection and visualization. The meditation, reflection, visualization given in Brahmin life. Listening is, and playfulness is our lightness and our appreciation. They come within our communication. But do we get the creativity in there?
I'm thinking, so, you know, a few Brahmins, and of course non-Brahmin is the same, but sometimes they get into a very depressed mode and they would say, well, this is my thyroid not functioning, or we find physical causes. And I always wonder really what starts and who triggers who. Is it really that, you know, we do have the body or the chemistry of the body imposing its reality, or is the mind can really overturn that systematically without necessarily, you know, taking lots of medication and stuff like that? And I'm thinking also of Dadi Jenki, because she's kind of a puzzle to science, where her body should be dead a long time ago, and it seems that the brain has been really resurrected the body about 84 times in the last few years. So who comes first, and what
well,
is your experience?
Well, I'd like to ask you the question, who comes first, soul or the body? So when the soul enters the body, you put your vibrations of your sanskars on the fetus as it's growing. So it grows into your sanskar format. So you then emerge whatever is there in your sanskars in your that daily. So what the particular weakness for me is in my throat, but you know. It could be there from last birth or the previous birth. You could have been carrying that weakness for birth after birth after birth. So you won't see the cause this birth. But if the soul creates it, the soul can change it. I believe there's been a study of multiple personalities in one body. And there's one personality that will need to wear glasses, and the other personalities don't. And one of the personalities has diabetes, and the other personalities don't. This is amazing. That the body switches according to the personality. And can switch fast. It is incredible that the miraculous healing that does take place through change of consciousness, it does exist, and it does happen, but it's very hard to say, oh, you're sick, you should just fix it. Fix it. You created it, fix it. But we can't just fix it like that, can we? Because it is so deep. And sometimes it might take a few births to sort it out. Or get the new one be fixed. New birth be fixed. Be nice next birth.
Oh, we're trying to fix it. One ingredient, I think, that we also want to use in that equation is the intoxication. So do you find that intoxication could be an ingredient that, you know, restores the balance or that can be helpful?
Certainly. If you have, what's the body set up for intoxication? What's the thoughts like? What are your thoughts like if you're intoxicated? Can we have some examples, please? Speak. Bolo, bolo. I'm an angel, I'm a deity. Powerful thought patterns for flying stage. Baba's come specially for us. And so, what would be the metabolic rate? Would you be slow? Would you be super fast? What? You think slow? Fast? Okay. What would be the body tone? Be really floppy? Or we hyper? Light. Stable. It'd be a kind of an in-between. Everyday life. You are in yoga in everyday life, aren't you? No, no, we have to be, this is a 24-hour business. So is remembrance, of course. But. What else? Okay, I think that will do for now.
Well, if you want, I can share some thoughts on intoxication.
Share your thoughts on intoxication.
Because I think that Madhuban is the land of intoxication, and I don't know if you're like me, but the reason why when Shashiben asked me what's your topic, you know, backstage, and you have 5 minutes to answer because I'm informing, you know, Shiluben, this is a program. I don't know, how to keep intoxicated all the time, you know, something like that, how to maintain your intoxication. And to be very honest with you, I was actually just thinking about me, wondering how am I going to maintain my intoxication when I go back to Canada. I don't know about you, how many times you've been in Madhuban, and how many times you've been back from Madhuban, and how many times you felt the need to come back to Madhuban just to recharge the battery, because probably the battery went a little bit discharged along the course and during the year. And we wish, of course, that when we go back to, you know, our respective countries, like Baba says many times, we maintain this level of intoxication and whatever we've gained in Madhuban stays with us. But of course, our experiences is that most of the time it fluctuates. And I find that if we look at the notion of intoxication, actually in the lucky term, to be intoxicated is due to the injection of something quite specific, right? If you think of people who are intoxicated, normally they either use drugs or alcohol or different ways to get their level of thinking a little bit extravagant and a little bit out there. But for one purpose is to bring joy, it's to bring happiness. Nobody will, you know, deliberately intoxicate themselves to be depressed, isn't it? Or do you know someone who consume in order to be depressed? They might get depressed, that's another problem. But normally they want to get high. And I think that what Baba is giving us is also this ingredient. Why is Baba using this term, intoxication, which is a very strange one to use in the beginning for newcomers? When they say, how do you feel? Oh, I feel very intoxicated. Say, what? Are you sick or are you consuming something toxic? And I don't know, it's spiritual intoxication. And I think that in the same way that lucky people have to increase their dose to maintain their intoxication, right? Somebody who is dependent on alcohol or drugs in order to get high, where along with time, he needs to increase the dosage, usually, until they usually die, right? Ultimately out of it. But for us, it's a little bit the same thing. You know, the intoxication that we're using has to be increased, the dosage has to be increased all the time. Otherwise, we won't be satisfied. And I find that in my Brahmin life, there has been many occasions where, of course, the level has went down, and go back to Madhuban, or you meet a daddy, or we do special efforts, and the level goes back up again, then it goes down again. And we heard many classes on how to maintain it on a theoretical level, but on a practical level, I find it's not a simple thing, and it's a big challenge. And there was one thought that really, really helped me a lot, which those who have been to Sister Denise's class last week, anyone has been to Denise's class? She's talking about one element which is very interesting, which is to be neutral when facing negativity or positivity. And I find that for me, the reason why we lose intoxication is usually because we give power to negativity. We make it very real, very important, very painful, and that will naturally remove, in my experience, the level of intoxication. And one thing that I think is very nice to be aware of is that physical intoxication, anyone who takes drugs or alcohol or whatever as a way to get high, is actually something they do in order to avoid having to face their own emotions. The real sense of becoming dependent and, you know, drug user, or alcoholic or whatever, is because after a while, if you stop using the material that makes you intoxicated, you can't face your emotions. Now, with spirituality, it's quite interesting what Baba is doing with us, because it works exactly the same way. That the intoxication Baba gives us is actually meant to create a new emotion about the self, which will be real, which will be authentic. But I think also that the reason why our intoxication fluctuates is because we use a lot of wrong intoxication. And I think that it was made reference to in earlier, so when Baba was talking about different forms of bossiness, and he was using the words, for example, the bossiness of the intellect, or the arrogance of the intellect, of possessions, of relations. And in the same way, I find that sometimes we get intoxicated in our Brahmin life, but we don't recognize that actually Maya has been, you know, slightly adding her own poison to the intoxication, so that suddenly our intoxication is, for example, oh, my state is very high, and I got good churning, and oh, now I'm good, you know, now I'm going to make it, you know, that's it, now I'm victorious soul, and I'm Baba's right hand, and we have all these beautiful thoughts. But actually Maya is saying, oh, this is my opportunity to use this intoxication to play with the ego of the person. And because that intoxication is not entirely pure, then it doesn't last long. You know, it will have to be renewed again and again with this ingredient. And I find that when we try to question the level of our intoxication and the quality of the intoxication, then we become, first of all, much more neutral about good and bad, and we get intoxicated about different things. And I think the intoxication that Baba wants us to have is the intoxication of yoga, the one that comes from the relationship we have with Baba. It's not necessarily an intoxication about how great and wonderful I am, because that is a reality, but it's also not such a reality at the moment. But our relationship with Baba can be a source of very pure intoxication. So when we look at maintaining intoxication, I think that what we look at in the beginning is redefining the quality of our intoxication. And the quality of the intoxication comes from what you consume to get high. So you might want to make a list of what is your favorite ingredient to get high. Do you have any ideas what do you use to get high? What makes you high? Let's play a game. Just see how would you, what would you do if you want to get high spiritually?
You mean chai?
Huh? Chai? Chai, yeah.
Or you mean merly points?
More towards the merly point, yeah. Spiritually high. But seriously, anyone is using sometimes an approach, a method, really with the purpose of uplifting the consciousness. Yeah?
Good one, very good one.
Anyone else, what is your method to really rise the level of your intoxication? Not just to churn merely points so that we churn, or that sitting in yoga so that we sit in yoga and remember Baba, because these are being ordinances that are given to us. We're told to do certain things. But when we really want to improve our own level of, you know, happiness and intoxication, is there anyone who does very specific things? Yes, is there? Yeah. That's a yukti Baba has given us very often, you know, take a picture of you as a deity form and take a picture of you as an ordinary form. So, some pictures of our Brahmin life. Sister, before, really? So, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. There was someone else who wanted to share.
Maybe I've answered it.
That can, yeah. I can share one. Yes, sister? Good. So, Sita? Acha, you cannot hear what she was sharing? Acha? She was saying that when she has the opportunity, when she goes to work, for example, or during the day, when she really feels that she can share Baba's love and the notion of service, is that really which makes her intoxicated? And when there's the opportunity to share love and to give others Baba's love, then that gives her a big high, you know, a big jump. Sister, you want to chat? Huh? Try to speak as loud as you can. Oh, maybe.
When I see glowing souls like Brahma Baba and daddies, and we know we can become like them, and I see my future, my future. Lakshmi Narayan, and also after a deep yoga with Baba, I have a very deep joy, and it's a very intoxication for me. A joy explain. It's when Maya come, I see Maya or Ravan. It's very Ravan seems very strong, and I make effort to remember that intoxication.
One thing that's helped me a lot with intoxication is using creativity in my Brahmin life, especially using Baba's knowledge in writing. This one time I was writing a short story and it had a lot of gyan in it and it lasted for maybe about a week. But when I came to Murli during that period of time, it was like I listened to Murli in such a different way, as if it really came to life. And another thing which I did at another time was churn the Murli every day after the Murli for about an hour. And it was after actually I had been in kind of depressed, quite depressed actually. And just it was such a switch just being going into this writing. And it was kind of like forced to do that because I had to do something. And it was really like magic. So it went from like very low to very high, just from writing, churning Baba's knowledge through writing, basically what points in Baba's Murli, how they all connect and how they connect to my life.
The trick is like an appreciation journal, just keeping notes at the end of the day of what you've appreciated from Baba in your life or your skills, whatever.
I'd like to share maybe one thought that also we can connect with keeping a balance, because I think that the problem with intoxication is that it can create imbalance. I'm sure you've gone through your years of, and I appreciate us so very much when we start our Brahmin life, but I know that one of those, and maybe Joe, you've been like that in the early days, we tend to be extremely high and sometimes a little bit too high, and we do very entertaining things under the effect of intoxication, right? Anyone is laughing about their early days when Baba says, remember the days of your childhood? Any of you start laughing? No? Because sometimes when we, I know when I took Gyan, we were told, of course, about these great ideas that, you know, Baba is coming, destruction is also coming, Maya is also coming, and there's so many things coming, so, you know, we know that everything is coming. And then we're told we have to go, so that's very entertaining. And then we get a little bit excited about our Brahmin life, and you start calling your parents and your family, and you tell them, you know, how wonderful this life is, and you're going to India to meet God because He has come, and you decided to give your life, and you're dying a life, and they are your brothers, they're not your fathers and mothers and friends, they're all your, my sweet brother, you know, and your dad really thinks you went mad, you know. So this is a kind of intoxication that is a little bit dangerous, but I think that I've seen it a lot. And sometimes I see people at the center who come, you know, and they look like they're flying, you know, very nicely, but you're just getting very concerned with them. You know, you say, oh my God, what will they do when they come out of the center? And what will they say to the person on the street, you know, where you come from? And to give you an idea of how intoxicated I've been, so I'll confess to you, when I came in Gyan, my war robe was about black, you know, it was black. I had a lot of black shirts, black pants, everything was black. I like black. And one day I understood the new trend in Brahmin life is white. All right, take it all out and then slowly replace it with white. And I used to wear a kurta pajama in Montreal, you know, all day long with my Om Shanti badge, my third eye open, and I would go on my bicycle, and I would just go in a city with my kurta flying. And I was very intoxicated, and I thought, well, this is our angel dress, you know, what's wrong with it? So I would be one day in my bicycle, you know, riding on Baba's remembrance with my kurta flying nicely with the wind, and here comes a guy with his speed bicycle, dressed with his, you know, kind of spider hat and tight outfit, you know. No, on a bicycle. No, just like speed and sound like a sport bicycle, yeah. But an outfit which was very, very different than mine. And he just comes along and passes by and he says, wow, where did you get that? You know, this is cool, man. So he thought I was probably having a new kind of fashion statement. And I swear on, you know, all the daddy's heads that what I told him was, well, my father is an angel, and I want to become like him. So this is my angel dress. Would you like to know where I got it from? And the guy said, what? You're becoming an angel? Which planet are you from, man? But because I was so high, you know, we ended up doing bicycle together. And I went a long detour to accompany him up to his workplace to give him Gyan on a bicycle in traffic jam in Montreal. Me in my kurta pyjama and him in his kind of sport suit, you know, going along. And I was giving him the whole course, you know, that cycle and everything. So when he went to work, he probably had the most entertaining story to tell everyone. Guess who I met this morning on a bicycle? I met an angel. And I won't tell you everything we did, you know, in our early days, but enough to create hours and hours of memories that are very entertaining. So sometimes over-intoxication is not too bad, at least for storytelling, you know, later on in Gyan. But on the other hand, it can create a little bit of confusion. And I remember when I was so high that I wrote, I recorded a cassette at the time to send to my family. So I took the tape recorder and I told them the whole thing, you know, like what I believed in and what's happening and destruction is coming. And now if you don't mind, I'll share a little commentary for you, you know, play music and then give the commentary and told them, and now I'm going to India. I'm meeting God because He's coming March 24th at 10:30 or whatever. Om Shanti. And I sent that to all my parents, brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. And I got a call from my grandmother. Eric, do you know that in India, they're very, you know, dangerous gurus? Next week in the mail, I had a pile of, you know, articles and things that she collected for me. showing how terrible things were happening in India, you know. And anyway, so at that time I thought, well, maybe it was over the top, you know, this little tape. And when I went back to my family years later, I ended up searching everywhere for those tapes, you know, to just find them again and erase them and trying to hide them away. So, I mean, this is a kind of intoxication I'm sure you're not doing anymore, because this is outdated and it's old-fashioned. That was, you know, years ago we used to do that. But I still see sometimes that there are some kinds of intoxication that are very, it makes us feel good, but it doesn't necessarily make us do the right things. And I would suggest to you to check, when we shared earlier about different types of intoxication and how to reach this stage of intoxication, what will be your relationship between intoxication and success? And I find that one way to guarantee that our intoxication is not just a big high in our head that will, you know, disappear after a while, is to see how much we can sometimes get proper intoxication on the basis of an accumulation of success. And I share one thought that really changed entirely my life over the last few months, because I have a full-time job, which is quite demanding, and the center is also quite demanding. And for the last many years, I've been always known as being very busy. And even Sister Moini would say sometimes, oh, Eric has come, but he's so busy. And work, everybody will come to me and ask me, do you have a minute? I would always say no. I have 30 seconds. And my schedule was always very, 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 very busy. And I always keep thinking I'm very, very busy. And when I went to a retreat recently, I heard this very simple thing again, that your thoughts create your reality. And for the first time I realized that keeping the thought, I'm busy, was actually making me more busy. And I thought, wow, this is took me so many years to suddenly make that equation. And I realized that one day I would go to work and I would decide, today I'm not busy anymore. And that identity of being always busy was never to me a bad thing, in a sense, like it was not a sin or it was not a, it's not a bad, you know, karma to be busy. But then today I realized that no, it is actually not an identity that I want to keep. And Sister Moini was telling us, you should never look busy. And I thought, whoops, you know, and then we're joking, so how do you look like when you're not busy? And how many of us have never said to someone, well, sorry, I'm a bit in a rush and, you know, I have to go. Well, how many times people talk to us and you listen, but in the back of your mind, you're already planning what I have to do next and this and the other. So one day I showed up at work and I decided from today on, my new identity is I have all the time in the world. I'm free. I'm not busy. And so when I started to announce that at work, they were laughing. You know, they were saying, do you have a minute? And I said, yeah, please come in. I have all the time in the world. And say, something is wrong with him. You know, it doesn't work. And to be very honest, what I found is that by changing that pattern of thinking, it literally changed my reality also at work. And I find that suddenly emails were not jammed anymore. The pile of paper on the desk was slowing down or reducing. And of course, my attitude was getting much more pleasant. And I would say that from that change comes a kind of intoxication, which I can still feel today. And I find that these kind of intoxications, when we really go into a change of consciousness and a realization that we apply and that we see the success coming, that really gives a sense of intoxication. We can be intoxicated by thinking, I'm a future deity soul, I'm a future angel, I'm Baba's child, I'm Baba's right hand. Of course, this will rise our level of consciousness. But if we don't, I think, apply it in a very specific way to make a change in our own day-to-day life, that intoxication might not really take us where we want it to be. And whereas when we feel that some change have been made very, very practically, and if you think of the last few years or however long you've been with Baba, that you've really made some changes in your life that became permanent, how much that has been sustaining us in our own identity. Because for me, intoxication is related to two things, is success and self-esteem. If intoxication is not really grounded in self-esteem, it's like the other form of intoxication, which is designed to take us away from the real emotion. So if we are intoxicated with jnana, with yoga, with service, but it's not increasing our sense of self-esteem, I think there's always the danger it's going to blow up at the moment, at any time, and then we're going to feel flat once again. But if there's self-esteem and success, then the level of intoxication, I think, for me anyway, it really becomes much more a level that I can rely on a long-term basis. What do you think? Is that possible, or is it helping for balancing?
Definitely fantastic. And it seems like I remember being really proud that I was busy, and I like to demonstrate I was busy all the time because that meant I was important. Because busyness was meant your proper yogi, weren't you? Busy.
Yeah, we almost feel intoxicated when the phone rings every 10 seconds and emails pop in all the time, and somebody's in your office and says, "Wow, you're a busy person." And if you, there's an ego in there, you know, that it seems that busyness seems being important. So.
It is an interesting concept. I think I decided that there was a point in my Brahmin life when I made a decision that I'm either a yogi or I'm a busy bee, you know, and the busy bee wasn't being very healthy, and I wasn't being particularly happy, and so I decided, well, I've got to make some changes. So I stopped being busy and started being a yogi. So that's made a big difference to me as well. I think I'm a nicer person to be with when I decided I'd be a yogi. This is only a few years ago, by the way. Because you can think, well, I'm following a Brahmin life, I'm a yogi. But there's a difference between practicing meditation and actually being doing the internal meditation. There is a difference.
And I think it's so lucky people, when they see us with the right type of intoxication, they will feel balance in our life. When they see us with the wrong type of intoxication, they get really worried about us. And when I started working at CBC, which is a public television, I showed up in white, you know, with my badge again, and not my bicycle at that time, but I was still in white, and my box of food, you know, that was always yellow. So I used to be called the man in white with yellow food. And you know, that was my name, because I was only cooking Indian food with a lot of curry, so it was always yellow. And at work, they used to tease me because they keep thinking, "You're always in white, and you're always eating yellow food. What's wrong with you, you know?" And I was playing always my little meditation music during lunch hour, and they used to call it my aquarium music, you know, like fishbowl music, where you put to, you know, for aquarium or fishbowl. And I think they used to tease me a lot, and they used to find me really weird, I think, in the early days. But since I was nice and I was kind of working okay, they couldn't fire me. And that level of intoxication, I would say, was not really the best advertising for Baba. It didn't end up doing too much disservice, but I don't think that was the best advertising I could do at the time. And today what I find is that people are really looking at us very, very deeply. And the more you grow into your professional life, I find that people around us that end up knowing that we're very spiritual, that we practice meditation, they might end up knowing we're celibate and that we follow certain principles of life. They look for the flaws because we challenge their own reality also. And I find that, for example, the situation I find myself at work in is very often one where, for example, a director or someone else will have a strange behavior, and they will maybe even swear, for example. And very often they turn towards me and they say, "Oh, sorry." I always say, "Why do you tell to me sorry when we're 10 in a room? You can tell sorry to everyone." So I feel sometimes they're looking at me as a priest, you know, and they think that if the priest is in the room, you know, better, as soon as you swear, you should turn and say, "I'm sorry." But I found that unconsciously, I think that's because they're challenged in their own reality. And what I found is that when our intoxication is real, and our stage is very high, and we go to work, and we show up with other people, with, you know, the mundane world, they see that intoxication as a guarantee of balance also. But the moment our intoxication is a little bit funny, they use it as a sign of imbalance. They look at us as, well, these guys are really off on another planet. And that's where I think it's dangerous, and we can tell you know, by the reaction of lucky people, if our intoxication is real or not. And my experience has been that whenever I was told one day that when I was coming back from Peace Village, it's one person who told me that at Hori to say, oh, you've got your Peace Village look. I said, what do you mean I have my Peace Village look? You know, they said, well, every time, and that's honestly a very non-spiritual person who works with me who told me that one day, and I was very surprised. And she said, well, every time you come back from that retreat, you have that look, you know, which is very different. And I thought, wow, this is interesting that we have that. It's kind of marked on us. So I think keeping the balance in our life is, yes, of course, sometimes, you know, looking at working and resting or, you know, doing Baba service, but also taking care of our lokiks and different responsibilities. But I think the balance starts really with the ways we balance our consciousness between, you know, going high, but also sometimes we're not so high. And so we keep a balance in the sense of really questioning the quality of our intoxication. And I find from my experience that when I try to relate to Baba, I would say that what I gained from this visit in Madhuban, in my experience, was two things. One was a redefinition of yoga with Baba and trying to find a new way to connect with Baba. And for me, it was just using the word father in French, because my mother tongue is French. And I've never really related to Baba so much as father. You know, Baba is sweet because we can accept that. And so now when I'm meditating in Madhuban lately, I've tried just to say, Father, I want to feel your presence. And it just changed suddenly the whole dynamic. And the second thing that I found very new for me this time was some levels of soul consciousness, to redefine how do I really, really go into soul consciousness. And exploring new ideas that will make me soul conscious in a way that is much deeper. And what I've practiced for the last few days is to look at my body from the outside and see that this is not who I am. Anyone wants to share something or add something or ask something? Personally, I don't try very much to share gyan with very close friends or with co-workers. I think that most people will come to know anyway what I'm doing. What I've really, really experienced is that by giving them good respect, like very, very sincere appreciation, lots of love, inspiration, encouragement. Baba very often says the biggest gift you can give someone is a virtue or power. And I find that when they go through some difficulties using gyan and trying to help them and giving them some advice or going along with their own stories and trying to accompany them in what they go through, I find that usually that brings them very, very close. For me, I have quite a few very good friends at work, and they've all come to the center. They know what I do. They heard a little bit of gyan. Some even went to retreats now. Lately, there were two lucky friends that ended up coming to a retreat in Peace Village with me. And it was very interesting to suddenly find your friends, you know, in a car, driving to Peace Village and then coming back and talking about the cycle and about all kind of things in the car with friends. It sounds always very interesting. But to me, I really believe that by having lots of love for people, we bring them close, and they become close contact souls at the right time. And I find that those who have to become Brahmins, they will anyway ask questions, they will want to find out, and they will give us signals that they are ready to listen to gyan. But I find that until someone is indicating to me that they are ready to get gyan, I found by experience that it doesn't help much giving pure gyan. I use gyan a lot at work, in my work, but in a very practical way. So when we have meetings or when we have conflict of personalities, you know, I would use Baba's knowledge to implement solutions at work. And that's usually enough sometimes to trigger people's interest in what I do. For example, there was a situation where a co-worker came to me recently and she said, Eric, I never told you one thing, but my closest friends go to your center every week to the lectures that we, at the center in Montreal, every Wednesday night, we give a lecture on different topic. And one of the latest mentor that I found that really helped me a lot and made me very intoxicated was the story that Sister Moini told us that was very funny, where there was a big situation going on in New York at some time, and Sister Moini was coming to meet, in Madhuban. So she told a few seniors in New York, well, I'll get answers from Baba when I'm in Madhuban. And so she presented the problem to Daddy Gulzar. And Daddy Gulzar said, yeah, okay, I'll tell you what the solution is. And we're talking about a big situation going on. And then so Daddy Gulzar went back to Sister Moini and said, well, Baba said everything will be okay. And Sister Moini said, yes, did you say something else? You know, like, do we do something about it, or we just say everything will be okay? And Sister Moini, the way she was sharing, said that she knew if Daddy tells her everything will be okay, there must be some significance in that. So she went back to New York and told everyone about this big situation, everything will be okay. And we said, what? You know, that's all? That's all God is telling us? Everything will be okay? But for strange reason, they all accepted that solution. Everything will be okay. So they all started to spread to the other level of, you know, work, other brothers and sisters who were saying, well, so what? So what do we do? What do we do? And Kalaben and everyone else would say, you know, well, everything will be okay. And so they all became very convinced that everything will be okay. And Sister Moini was saying, within just a few weeks, what was really the cause of the problem solved itself by itself. There was no, they didn't intervene, they didn't do anything, they didn't challenge the people who were involved. They just let it be with the thought everything would be okay, and everything went okay. So I was sharing that with the classes in the evening. And so that student who was coming on a regular basis ended up going through a very big situation in her life. And when she shared that with the person who works with me, the person who works with me was very concerned and said, oh, wow, what are you going to do? And this is such a big thing. And, you know, this is very serious. What are you going to do? And she said, well, everything would be okay. And her friend, who is then working with me, thought she was totally nuts, you know. So anyway, she was one day at a meeting, and at CBC we had a big thing going on. And everybody asked me, so what do we do? What do we do? And I just told everyone, don't worry, everything would be okay. So that person came to my office and said, Eric, there's a setup here. My friend is telling me everything will be okay. You tell us everything will be okay. I'm sure there's a conspiracy somewhere. And where do you get that thought from, you know, that everybody now starts just to say everything would be okay? And her friend's situation went totally fine, and she didn't do anything. And at work, our problem really got solved all by itself. So this lucky friend with whom I never shared again before, I never told her anything. I know she knew I was involved with the meditation center, but she's the one who always talked about drinking, and she's a very totally different person. For the first time, she came to me and says, so, what's this whole thing about meditation? You know, and she's really on the other spectrum of anyone in the world you would ever think could be interested in meditation. But I've never tried to tell her anything. But just with that very practical application of Baba's Gyan, I find that sometimes if it really works and there's some proof, and they come to you and they say, now tell me about it. One of the biggest director at CBC is pretty very rational person, extremely cultivated and, you know, not religious whatsoever. And there was some people who brought him a report on the Brahma Kumaris being a sect, saying, Eric is with this group. You should do something about it. So it went in a whole board of directors at CBC that I was involved in a sect. And the French report is pretty scary when you read it, that Brahma Kumaris is a apocalyptic sect and everything. So one day I came to know that all the board of directors where I work are having this report in their hands and questioning whether or not I'm entitled to continue my work. I can swear your heart starts going a little bit faster when you know that. And your boss calls you and says, Eric, you have been denounced. That's what they told me. You have been, is it a proper word in English? Denounced? Like somebody told us about you, you know, we know the truth. Someone reported about you. So I felt like my heart was about to explode, and I thought, oh my God, what's going on here? So I told them very straightforward what I was doing, and it didn't go anywhere really, actually, because they couldn't find reason to fire me or to change my job. And on the contrary, what happened actually is that they promoted me. And they gave me, you know, one of really kind of the most interesting jobs. And all of my coworkers knew about the situation. It was very interesting because they changed their way of thinking. I had one producer who came to me one day and said, "So, apparently now you're the leader of a new sect in Montreal." Jokingly, you know, but I thought that was not funny at all. And that was coming from that report. And this director, one day we had to drive 2 hours together to another city. 2 hours he interviewed me about my lifestyle, about meditation, about the Brahma Kumaris. I was so nervous in the car because I was like, my goodness, what do I tell him? So we had a nice chit-chat, but I found that really people, when we try to give them gyan, it doesn't necessarily work so well. When we're just being very honest, we give them respect, we give them love, they want to know certain things. And this guy now, this director, he's the one who supports me the most in what I do. So when I told him I wanted to come to India, it's not really necessarily the best timing for me, but he said, "Okay, I know it's important for you, so you go." I got permission to come.
I think with people who know us very well, they know all our weaknesses, they know all our strengths. And when we come into Gyan, we don't necessarily change all our sanskars instantaneously. So we can say that, "Oh, we're like this, like that, it's fantastic, fantastic." And they go, "Yeah, but what about that, and that?" So if you do it by example, like they see the change in you, then rather than telling them what you think you are or what you're trying to be, it has a bigger impact. You've been wanting to say something, yeah? The pastor, what do you mean? Well, it's true. Yeah. No, I didn't understand any of that. So that is an interesting situation, like where I was having, when I was new in Gyan, no one knew what a Brahma Kumari was supposed to be. You're in a situation where people have a preconceived idea about what it is to be a Brahma Kumari. So you're in a different scenario than a lot of us in the West. And I think it's the same for anyone. If somebody wants to be, you know, a really good athlete, a top sports person, and they say, "Right, I have now taken up this particular sport." If someone said, "Well, why aren't you entering the gold medal thing next year?" Well, of course not. I can't become perfect at this sport in 1 year. So we have to, we know it, everything takes time. Baba says 1 second it takes, but, you know. But in reality, your answer can just be, "Well, it's a practice I've taken up. Please help me. That'll be very nice. If you can point out what I ought to be doing, that's thank you very much." But, I mean, I avoid telling anybody I'm a Brahmin.
But it's good, I think, opportunity to correct the image people have of the Brahma Kumaris. Because I think sometimes people, you know, if someone tells me, "Well, you're supposed to be perfect, why are you doing this?" They have the wrong idea, or I give them the wrong idea, or they got it from somewhere else. But for me, I find that most people, if we explain properly, that our journey is really one of, you know, we strive, we want to change, we want to improve ourselves, and we show them how we do it, but also we show them how it would be useful for them. I think that people should not feel that, you know, we should be perfect. In the past, I used to be told that because I was projecting that image about the institution also. That, you know, we are becoming such great people. But today I find that I promote more the idea that, you know, if we want to improve ourselves, we gain our own happiness. And the message I like to give people is more that our level of happiness comes from our own qualities. And the more we develop our qualities, of course, the more happy we are. So when they see us as on a process of change and growing, they really feel actually mercy on us. They feel compassion. They feel that they want to support us. The people I talk to, I find that it's important to be very honest with them. I have a few close friends with whom I'm not kind of shy, or I'm not ashamed to tell them that I'm not doing so well today, or I'm struggling with this. And I have very close friends, some of them who wanted to be priests before, who didn't become priests. You know, when we have to share about, when you tell them you're celibate, I think we shouldn't project the idea that oh, no problem, you know, easy, we're following all this lifestyle, no problem. I mean, they want us to be real. And I think when people know we are real, they really, really get so, it's a different dynamic. But if we project this image where we don't want to show any kind of flaws because we feel we'll be defaming the institution or Baba's name, I think we're projecting the wrong image of what we're really doing.
I think one of the things that happened when I was, one of the crazy things for me in my early Brahmin life was that I just ignored my Lockett family. They were in Colchester, I was in London, I was studying, I just, you know, basically ignored them. And they ignored me, and that was fine. It's quite satisfactory, really. I got on with Brahmin life and my study and my work and service. And I had a kind of picked up a few feelings that my brothers and my sisters. Sister was a bit upset that I wasn't being the helpful auntie and doing babysitting and this and that and helping out. But and then my sister died when she was 48, and so her daughter was 16, and her son was already at university. And she'd written in her will that the minor, those under 18, her children who are under 18, will be looked after by me. I didn't even know I was an executor for her will, me and my brother and myself, and I didn't know she'd written this in. And I was living in London, and they were living on the far coast of Wales. So it's a 6-hour drive from London. And this happened just before Christmas. And so instantly my brother and I, we went there, we were in Wales for a week. We sorted the funeral, tried to sort out all the affairs. And then I went back at Christmas and went into the house with my niece, and I spent 3 weeks there helping my niece go through all those things. And then I went back to London to work for 3 weeks, and again I went there for a few weeks, and I went back. Every 6 weeks I'd go back for a few days, and for that first year. And she pulled through, and she's fine. She's absolutely fine now. And I made some comment to my brother about something, and he said, after you've done what you did with Emma, I have no question at all. You know, like the respect I gained by supporting the member of family at the time of need had such an impact. I didn't know what or how I was going to do it. I mean, I hadn't seen her for 10 years. When she was 16, I hadn't seen her for 10 years. I mean, I didn't really know the child. But Baba, drama, will go. I have values, I have principles, she's my relative, she's only young, she doesn't know how to use a washing machine, you know, and she wants to live by herself, and it's like, oh my God. But the support I gave her, and the esteem I have now for my family is huge. But they didn't value me before, because I just didn't interact with them. I'd turn up at Christmas, say hi, eat nothing and disappear. Usual sort of, oh, do as little as possible and then disappear. Bring my little nut roast, you know. And now again, one other scenario, another person was ill and I helped them. So I think it's like, it's your behaviour really makes the difference. It does turn the table. How are we doing for time? 25 past.
All right. Well, it certainly helped me a lot. Well, it's very true, because the first time I met Baba, actually the sister Denise was translating directly from Hindi to French. And the first thing Baba told me was, you're a very courageous soul. This is why Baba gives you lots of help, and you're a victorious soul. And I remember that my response to that in my mind was saying, no, this is not true, and I'm a failure. And I was very, you know, struggling a lot in my early days again. And I found that I couldn't see it. You know, I thought Baba was just trying to be nice to me. So I told Baba, I asked him, am I from Silver Age? And I thought that because I was always struggling, I thought maybe I'm from Silver Age, not from Golden Age. My advice to you, never ask Baba this kind of question. Because it got very scary, and at that time Baba, you know, he sits nicely, at the time it was in Om Shanti Bhavan, and we would come in front of him, I'll be sitting here and he will be there, and nicely like this. And when I ask in French, am I from Silver Age, Denise started to laugh. And she had a hard time to translate it in Hindi because she was laughing too much. So Baba was like, what is going on here? So finally she said in English, and I think Mohini Ben translated. And Baba literally jumped out of the gaddy. I thought he was going to, I don't know what, but he went like this, you know, really wrong. On the table, put his two hands on the table, his face was about there, you know, and close encounter with God. That was quite dramatic. And I just remember saying, nay, nay. just asking, you know, just curiosity. just asking. Sorry, no problem. I believe you. I'm out of here. I will never ask question again to God. And he went on for a long time, you know, trying to convince me that I was from Golden Age. And it was, in a way, a good yukti to ask this stupid question to God, because I was just afraid what he would do afterwards. But I remember always this very sweet Baba loving, when he understood the question, the face completely changing and jumping on the table. And he has so much power, you know, there's so much energy in that, and the love that came with it. To be very honest with you, in those last more than 20 years, so many times when I felt that that's it, I'm stuck. You know, what can I do? I'm stuck. I just can't move forward. And I always remembered that blessing. I always remembered the love that Baba gave me, and when he was saying that, you know, you're a victorious soul. I keep thinking, okay, if Baba said it, it must be right. You know, I should have that trust and that faith in the blessing. And using that blessing has been used a million times in my Brahmin life, and it's been really, really the main source of inspiration. And that kindness, you know, when he let me go finally after 20 minutes of arguments about me from Golden Age, he almost told me which V-man I will have, and, you know, castles, and it was very specific ideas about Golden Age that he told me at that time. I felt that he gave me the toli, and he was holding my hands, you know, saying, Okay. And I said, yeah, fine. Second meeting I had with him, I still had another question for him, but that's another story. So yeah, remembering those blessings is very... But you know, there are also blessings Baba gives now to all of us, which I find as powerful. And the topic I've been really inspired with the last year was about those stars of hope. And Baba has been insisting last year about... You have to bring hope in people's heart so that they can become the light of hope. And when Baba talked to the double foreigners in the 31st, he finished with this line that, you know, you are the stars of hope and you will bring the stars of hope. And I really felt as if he was acknowledging my personal, objective for this year. So I felt very, very intoxicated also.
This is a completely different type of experience, but it's a Bapdada experience as well. This is my first trip to Madhavan, and I arrived in Delhi and instantly got a cold, and I came up here. And by the time we arrived up the mountain, it was dark, and Baba was already here, and he was sitting in this hall, and double foreigners down this side where the headphones were. And so we got changed in Yog Bhavan, and we came over, and the brother who was guiding me, Brother Richard, he took me through the gates, past the... literature shop, over the rocks here, and straight into here. I've never been to this place. It's completely dark. I've got a fever. I'm flu-y. I really didn't know quite what was going on. And we opened the door, and I just sort of see this whole sea of people. And they'd started, the Murli had finished, and they were gathering around Baba. And I kind of felt really completely overwhelmed, you know. And so I kind of, sat down in the corner, and I just sort of burst into tears. I didn't know that I had a temperature and I was flu-y and anything else. I didn't quite realize that. But I was totally overwhelmed. Like, this is God? You know. But the last thing you should do in the presence of God is cry. If you want to maintain your decorum and sit in the background. Somebody noticed. And it was quite a strong brother who decided to notice and decided that I have to sit in front of Baba. If I was crying, then you have to get it fixed, right? And the quickest way to do it is put this soul in front of Baba. And the last thing I wanted to do is go and sit in front of God when you're crying. That's just like, you know, I was just like, what's going on? And so I started to fight. I didn't want to do it, you know. Then I realized that I wasn't going to win. So they put me in front of Baba. I'm like, whoa. And he said, fascinating thing, right? The separation is now over. Now it is time to dance in happiness. And so that phrase I have used so many times to really support me. When I got back to London, the story had it that I came in at the back of the hall, I saw Baba, and ran straight into his arms. I think I quite like that idea too, but I haven't tried that one yet. But this phrase is quite funny because my name is Joy, I was being already doing dancing as service, and the whole sort of like you actually know me. Like, you know me. It's really funny. Anyway. I think we can have some meditation now on those two blessings.
Yeah, and then lunch. Okay, thank you for listening, and Om Shanti, and see you soon.